one.
It's well, you just turn out the lights.
Oh, turn out the lights. Okay.
Well, let's play.
Let's play. Pause. Stop. Okay. So, but I'll pull it through here.
So. And turning up the volume is one of these, I think it's like.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, okay.
Oh, it's the plus one.
I think it's the plus one. Yeah. Sounds like Good choice.
So,
and we're
excellent.
Recording with this device.
Oh, you're going to record
me.
Oh, sure. I can just put it right here.
Okay.
Okay.
That's closing down.
They have some very good.
Oh, yes, we are. Sorry, yeah. We had this wonderful Sanskrit lunch, and so we just kept chatting.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm very pleased, everyone. Thank you for coming for this afternoon seminar. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome once again Anne-Marie Gaston to the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. Anne-Marie has for many, many years been an expert, is an expert in Indian dance. She has many years' experience in Indian dance. And her focus has been particularly on Shiva and the dance of Shiva. And today she's going to speak to us on the dancing Shiva as a focus for teaching cultural diversity. And you're going to show us some DVD.
So if you want to have a little piece of paper ready, when if you write something down, it's because basically we've prepared this the DVD, and we have a booklet that goes with it. And what we thought is that in preparing it, we just thought that people look at the image of Shiva, and they don't realize that it has much greater connotations. So without further ado, I'll show you the DVD, and pretend that you are a student, or you can also be yourself. So when we get the, as to what you would like to know more about, or if you think, oh my goodness, if someone coming in cold, it just wouldn't work. Because we're going to prepare a teacher's manual, and so it would be really helpful for us to, and of course you can also say what you like. It doesn't just need to be a critique. So we'll turn it on now, and that's fast forward. Play, here we go. Play, it says.
Yes, right. I should just play.
Yeah, play.
Can you see? Do you want to come on?
What is it? Play.
I think it's probably this one.
Play.
That's it.
Press play.
That's it.
That appears strange and inexplicable.
Okay, stop. Rewrite. Okay.
Despite wars and conquest.
Okay, stop. Stop.
People.
Rewind. There we go. Why isn't it rewinding?
It is not rewinding. Here's rewind.
Okay, there we go. And then we'll start from the beginning. Okay, here we go. Play. Play.
Let's play that.
Is this play here? Oh, here we are. So.
Oh, here it goes, yeah.
Okay. Can everybody see? Is anyone here?
India is a land with an immense diversity of customs.
More volume needed?
For the outsider, there is much that appears strange and inexplicable. Despite wars and conquests, the people of India have maintained many ancient customs. The accretion of ritual and ceremony sometimes obscures the deep philosophical foundations of a culture that has given rise to several of the world's great religions. At its root, Indian culture is based on deep and subtle ideas about the nature of the person and the world. To provide an introduction to India's fascinating culture, we will take as our starting point a single image, that of Nataraja, the dancing Shiva. This familiar icon provides a condensation of many elements that pervade Indian thought. Copies of the classical images are popular works of art and grace many domestic shrines. They derive from a small number of images in worship within the great temples of South India. Here, we see Nataraja images being cast by traditional artisans. Shiva is one of the most popular deities in India. He is most often worshipped in the form of a lingam, a symbol of fertility. Icons showing him in human form are also common. The most famous of these is Nataraja. This image, although familiar in all regions of India, originated in South India. Its design dates to the period of the Chola kings, who ruled South India from the 9th to the 12th centuries. Many of the vast temples that grace the lush countryside of South India are dedicated to Shiva. Here, the rituals of past centuries continue to be observed with enthusiasm. The temples provide not only places of worship, but social hubs around which the Hindu community revolves. Huge, many-pillared halls lead to the inner center. The temples form small cities in themselves. They are also important centers for pilgrimage. Indian temples were major patrons of the arts and formed important centers for dance, painting, and sculpture. Dancers were employed by the temples, but the same dances were also performed in royal courts, at weddings, and as entertainments. Many of the dancers in traditional India belonged to hereditary families, which included musicians and dance teachers. Today, Indian classical dances that are commonly performed in homes and theatres and by people of many nationalities all over the world are direct descendants of those performed in medieval temples. The music of the dance is very closely related to that performed in the temples. The rhythmic beating of the feet, characteristic of all Indian dances, is synchronized to the rhythm of the drum and to the spoken rhythmic syllables. The intricate hand gestures provide a rich vocabulary of symbolic meaning and can be used either to ornament the dance or to narrate mythological stories. Dance is said to have originated with Shiva, who, in his form as Nataraja, is king of dancers. The Nataraja image is universally recognized as one of great beauty, its attraction deriving from balance and harmony. Many aspects of the image allude to profound philosophical ideas. In his right hand, Shiva holds a damaru, a small drum that is played by shaking. The drum symbolizes creation. Shiva is said to have initiated the material world through the rhythm of his drum. The drum of creation is balanced by the fire of destruction. Shiva not only creates, but he destroys. In the left hand, the Nataraja image carries flames, symbolizing the completion of the cycle of birth and rebirth. Fire is also an important element in Hindu rituals of all kinds, not least in this Shiva temple. Shiva also presides over the continuity of the world. He is the preserver who maintains the harmony of the natural order.
Your body
is all the world. Your speech is all language. Your ornaments are the moon and the stars. Shiva, the pure. The Tamil New Year is known as Pongal and occurs early in January in the sprawling city of Chennai, previously known as Madras. City dwellers are just as eager to participate in the temple rites as their country relatives. Flower garlands are important during such celebrations and may be gifted to the deity. The Karpagumbal Temple is one of many temples in Mylapore, a district of Chennai. It is a major center for worship. Both gods and goddesses may be elaborately decorated as part of the ritual. During festivals, images are paraded within the temple, as well as, on special occasions, being conveyed through the streets. The decorated images are carried by priests and volunteers. In the past, such processions were accompanied by dancers who enacted songs relating mythological stories. Although the classical dances are no longer performed as part of worship in temples, the elaborate costumes of hand-woven silk and gold thread, as well as the jewellery, are similar to those used in the decoration of temple images. Ankle bells give a vibrancy and tension to the rich rhythm of the dance. Rhythmic passages alternate with descriptive poetry, to which the dancer enacts many of the rituals and practices of the temple. She creates elaborate descriptions of myths and gods through the use of mime and symbolic gesture. The different levels of myth in ritual, in images of bronze and stone, and in dance are perfectly combined in the performance of Bharatanatyam, a dance style of South India.
Upon opening the door of the sanctum, I beheld a wondrous hall. The deer in one hand, the axe in the other, with hair as red.
One Shiva legend relates that a group of sages tried to destroy him. They created a fire from which emerged a tiger, a trident, and a malignant dwarf. Shiva subdued all these dangers. When Shiva was in deep meditation in the Himalayas, the god of love tried to arouse his desire. Disturbed by this, Shiva used the power of his third eye to burn him to ashes.
When you were in deep meditation, the god of love tried to arouse your desire. Disturbed, your third eye opened, and you were.
Here, in Varanasi, on the banks of the river Ganges, the evening ritual allows us to experience the two sides of Shiva. Destruction is represented by the flames of the oil lamps, and creation by the pounding of the drums. The cyclical rhythm of Shiva's dance propels the creation and dissolution of the universe. This cyclical vision of both human life and the entire universe being constantly destroyed and recreated is fundamental to the philosophy and culture of India. The image of Nataraja, the dancing Shiva, embodies this important world view.
So some of you will see your names here. I'm sorry if I've forgotten some. So, we can turn it off, I think, unless some of you want to see your own names come up, because I had a lot of help from many of you. Thank you. There we go. Good. So, I hope you enjoyed that, and it wasn't, but I'd be interested in your comments as to what you thought when introducing this to, to students. We aimed it more, well, actually, some first-year university students, we felt it was fine, but did any of you have any comments about the age group that you felt it could be... Of the viewers.
No, it can be anyone. I think even a 10-year-old will be very comfortable with it.
This is what.
Tomorrow I'm teaching age and religion tomorrow.
No, it is for sale, I have to say. Unfortunately, we have to sell it because we have to pay for the thing. And it's £10 for both the booklet and the DVD.
Oh, right.
No, I hate
well,
to. I really hate to say that.
Tomorrow.
Oh, gosh, okay. Anyway, because that allows us then to keep printing more. And there is a booklet that actually goes with it, and this is a DVD in here. So anyway, so we're going to prepare one on Vishnu next. So so we'll be ready for that. So a lot of it we do in the live performance, and then so that was the performance that I did not this year, but the year before. And then and the pictures, and of course Andrew will have noticed several from the Victorian Albert Museum.
Various sources,
right? The other area where people find it interesting is the background of the dance, the dancers, and the fact, of course, even the people that were the drummers, the people playing the Nagaswaram and the different drums. These are from hereditary families, because as you know, the dance used to be a hereditary profession. So when I originally started to study the dance, it was with hereditary families that I actually studied the dance. So that was a very good introduction into it, because then you start. It helped me in my and you, if you want to have a peek at my book here. This was my thesis that I did here, in which I interviewed all the different families and discovered how they studied the dance and who then they were related to. As far as Andrew has to go, so it's okay. You come up. So this was very interesting, because it helped me to study about the repertoire, because as you know, the dance was once part of the ritual, but it was also performed very much in the concert stage. So there are two things that you'll read again and again if someone is giving a dance performance nowadays that has studied the dance. One is that it was the British that banned the dance. Now, I'd like to tell you, the British did not ban the dance in India. It was banned in 1947 at independence, and it was part of the trying to give women the ability to be able to go to school, to read and write, and it was felt that because if you were born into a certain community and you had to actually become a dancer, the dancers then, as most of you know, had other purposes as well. So these women, they didn't marry, but they were kept as courtesans, and some of them, of course, became very highly respected as musicians. And it's through this connection then that the dance survived. So when I started to do the dance, I studied with a man called Elipa Pillay. Now, he had been the Natuvanar, which is the person who conducts the orchestra, for the most famous of the present-day Devadasis. Her name is Bala Saraswati. So he then, because by virtue of having worked with her, he had her repertoire. So what we're speaking about now then is an oral tradition. Because if you study with one particular master, you learn their repertoire. And only he can conduct. So it's a real slave relationship you're in with this one person. So they then conduct the dance for you. You know their repertoire. So it's very interesting to actually study with different people. So another myth is that you study with only one guru. And so this was, again, why when I did my research, I learned that most of the very top performers had studied with many people, but somehow as they started studying with other people, they forgot who then their main master was. And so this was also interesting. When I was studying with my hereditary teacher, I kept wondering why he wasn't teaching his daughters. He wasn't teaching his daughters because if they had studied the dance, they then would have the stigma of being a prostitute. And so they could never, ever then get a regular marriage. And so he very carefully then didn't teach the dance to his daughters because he was from that hereditary community. Now, what is really interesting now is that in the period, and I thought that I wouldn't find so many people because I started being very serious about collecting the data in the 80s, but I started actually doing the dance in 1964. So there weren't many people doing the dance at that time. And the most famous of the dance schools, which most of you know about, Kalakshetra, that's another dance school. That dance school was then mainly, it was founded by a woman who married an Englishman, and she herself was a Brahmin, but all the students were all high-caste girls. They were all high-caste girls. And what's very interesting is that they studied with the traditional dance masters, but then they decided that they would then learn how to conduct recitals and everything. So now it's got a whole caste connection. So now it only became done by high caste people as far as with the dance. So some of the dances then that you learn about Shiva when you study with the traditional dance master and you study with the higher caste women, the whole repertoire is different because and what happens is that the high caste repertoire will only allude to the sexual imagery, whereas so for example, this is the god right here, so we can all try God Shiva. Okay, here he is. This is the god, and so I'm in love with Shiva. You see, so you from your heart, you have to try this too. Okay, so I'm in love with you, Shiva. You see, you can see your heart opening. Now the expression, of course, would be much more intensity if someone was from a hereditary family, whereas if someone was from a high caste family, they would have this. And then the language of the hand signs, this is actually, you know, being joined with someone sexually. And I remember sitting there, like, I was really young, and I was, yes, master, yes, you know, and watching all these things, and he was teaching me all this. But this is part of it, because as in many, in all faiths, in the Christian faith, in many faiths, the ideal union with God is a sexual union. And so when I do my creative pieces, I use pieces from St. John of the Cross because there are a lot of very, very interesting images. So when I was studying then about the god Shiva with the traditional dance master, and then again I've studied with the non-hereditary people, I found it was really interesting to make this different, contrast between how the repertoire was taught. And the other way it was different when you're studying is that because it was a group class in the non-traditional situation, it was very regimented. So in other words, if I want all of you to do Shiva, can everybody do Shiva? We do 1, 2, 3, Shiva. 1, 2, 3, 4. I am in love. So it has to be like that, doesn't it? Now, when you're studying with a hereditary master, the hereditary master just gives you the outline. So you can do whatever you want. You can listen to the music. You can flow. You can even change it. But what happens, and so this is how the dance is it has evolved and continues to evolve, because originally the classes were very small. as I said, I studied privately, and often there would be only like two or three people. And of course, many of the hereditary families, they then went and actually lived with the dance master. So it was who was probably some distant relative anyway. And so that the whole creation of the repertoire is very interesting. Now what is happening in Indian dance, which is very interesting, is that they're saying that because women, we should be independent, and the whole repertoire is considered totally irrelevant to today. Because how can young Indian girls come and touch the feet and, oh, my master, you know, like this? And the girls are saying, I can't do that. I really can't do that repertoire. And so what we're finding now is that the little pockets of people then trying to preserve the traditional repertoire, and then there are other people saying, we need a new repertoire for Bharatanatyam. It's totally irrelevant. We want to keep the dance style, but we don't want to actually do it. So this is what I found when I was actually, every time I go back and perform. And then, of course, I meet the dance masters and find out, you know, what is happening. But when we take the god Shiva, there are certain aspects that we do show in the dance as well. Now, I've brought some slides, but also we can just, I think maybe we'll just do that with the hand signs. So if we were talking about the god Shiva, first of all, is foremost, is the linga. So when everybody does, in your, there we go, and it's seated in the yoni. So we have the linga seated in the yoni here. Then usually he goes from the gateway. So can you show me the gateway? And you saw those huge gopuras there that he goes through. And how is he taken in procession? On his bull. So everybody show the bull. Here we go, the bull. And he is taken in procession on the bull. Now, this is the generic hand for, it can be a rabbit. You know, it can be a rabbit. It can be a deer. Because then, so now you're beginning to realize that there's a lot of poetry that you then have to be introduced in when you're learning about the god Shiva. So if this is a bull, can you show me the bull? Then Shiva rides on the bull. So we would know in this context of the hand signs that this is Shiva riding on the bull here. Now, if I was just describing a woman, and as you know, there's the whole Sanskrit tradition of how you look. And if you've got eyes, show your eyes, like a deer. See, like this. That means that you're beautiful. So you've got eyes like a deer. And in this context, it's the deer. Or you've got fish eyes. Fish eyes are very interesting, too. So you can just go like this. So you've got fish eyes. Fish eyes. So that when you're studying the dance, then you have to know what the Sanskrit ideas of beauty are as well. So you have to study. Now, of course, you've got a size like a plantain tree. So can everyone show the tree? And then you actually touch your thigh. Now, this same hand sign can also be a crown. So can you show me a crown? So this can be a crown, but it's also Lord Vishnu. So now we're getting into a whole other pantheon, aren't we? We have Lord Vishnu with the same hand sign, seeing that it is Lord Vishnu, okay? Now, who plays the flute? Krishna. Here we go. So Krishna plays the flute. Now, keep the same hand sign of the flute. Everyone got the flute? Play the flute. There we go. Krishna's playing the flute. Open the hand, the flower, and it's a bee. So it's the same hand sign. So there aren't actually that many hand signs. It's all in the context of how it's used, you see? So here we have the bee and the flower. This is the female and this is the male. All of you that know the Sanskrit text, the bee buzzing around the flower, right? So now if we go further, so we show Krishna. Now we know the 10 incarnations of Vishnu. So show me Vishnu. So first is Matsya. And then we have the tortoise, Kurma. See, two hands like that. One on top of the other. No, put the two palms facing each other. But this same hand sign is a young girl. You see here? So I'm showing about a young girl. But when I put my hands like this, it is the tortoise. Right here. Right here, the tortoise. And then when I take the same hand sign, it's a boar. Varaha, the boar. You see? The same, exactly the same hand sign. And then, of course, we get in half man, half lion, who is Narasimha, right. Now, you noticed in the story about the god Shiva that the ripping open of the tiger skin, and he ties it around his baby finger. He strips it with his baby finger and then ties it around his waist. Then we have Lord Rama. So everyone, it's a man. It's also a bow. So you take takes out the arrow, you put it in here, and you pull it back, and you let it go. Now, you notice I held my hand like that. Can you do that with the pointing and then like that? the hand like this, and then like that. This then is a goddess, and she usually has something there. But when I take it out, Parvati or something, when I take it out like this and then shoot it, this is a bow and arrow. So here, from here to just drop the middle, the pointing finger, the third finger there. So this then would be Parvati here. Or when a woman's shy, you know, she holds her. This is more of a North Indian tradition, but you know, when she goes like this, you see she holds it like that, and she holds it underneath the, you know, with it here. So you can see then, as we build up the different hand signs, then of course the Balarama, so Parasurama, who carries the axe. So we have he's before Brahma, but here we go. See the axe right here? He carries the axe. This can also be a knife. You can show me a knife. There we have. And then we did Rama. And then Balarama, who holds the plow. Just grab onto something like this and go, and he holds the plow and changes the course of the river Yamuna. And the next one. So who is the ninth incarnation? This is the thing. Is it Lord Buddha or Lord Krishna? So when I can remember, I was performing Let's Be Buddha, and we'll leave out Krishna here. Because in the Gita Govinda, they have the Buddha. And someone rushed up to me and said, that's totally wrong. But then Krishna is supposed to be even more powerful. He's just not an incarnation of Vishnu. So another story. So I could also have shown Vishnu here. And of course, the last one to come is Kalki on his horse. So we have it like this. And he's riding on his horse like this, carrying a sword and a shield. See the sword and the shield? Sorry. This can also be a mirror. So look in the mirror. There you go. Look in the mirror, and then you comb your hair with it backwards like this here. So so you're seeing that that what we tried in introducing the stories, we only were able to show them the actual relevant hand signs in this particular combination. But what you realize is that there are a very limited number of hand signs, but it's in the context of actually presenting it that we can tell the stories. And also, with these same hand signs, and you probably noticed it there, are used in a sense in which there's no meaning at all. So whereas, if you can hold your hands like this, just do the pointing finger in this one, if you just open it up like that, one, and close it, and open it, and close it, that can be flowers opening and closing, or it can just be beautiful, that's all. It can just be showing actually pure movement. Or you can do dat, te, tom, te, 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 tom, but this is still this can be the male, the phallus, can it? This can be the, or it can be Lord Shiva. So in this, you know, we were just alluding to this. I mean, this is just sort of extra material here that can go with this. Now, do you think that would be interesting to add with the in the teacher's manual? That's sort of the reason why I'm introducing. Do you think it would be just too much for the students to have? Anyone have any ideas?
One or two examples would be quite useful. Mm-hmm.
Of the, yeah.
I think it's worth putting them all in, but not necessarily compulsory, because I teach girls of about 20, and some of them really love doing this and would actually like to try all the gestures.
Uh-huh,
and,
okay.
Well, you've actually...
Yes, I have actually taught them, yeah.
Whereas there are always one or two... Actually, there aren't many who are shy, but if you were teaching some chaps or something,
yeah,
they might not be wonderfully keen on trying out being in a flower opening and closing.
Yeah, right.
So maybe it would be that nice to have it more.
Yeah, right.
If they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the teachers would want to have in the manual? Do you think that they'd want to have this or not?
I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They need to have a wider knowledge of what they're actually going to show or teach.
Uh-huh, right.
Which gives them a much better understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It stops it being too cerebral, the understanding of the culture. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people read about, you know, sort of they read words like orthopraxy and orthodoxy,
mm-hmm.
but they don't actually think that might actually apply
to
people doing different things or...
Yeah.
Gestures and
what we thought too is that because it's such a living tradition, you know, like it really, when you go into the South Indian temples, it really is a very living tradition. So this is what we tried to do in actually showing that, and also with the, it's just an everyday matter. It's not something sort of really special. It's just every day. That was what I was trying to, we were trying to show that it's very matter of fact when it's, because sometimes when some of these traditions come to the West, they become very precious. And sort of And whereas when you're actually in India, it's every day. It's just a part of the routine, so to speak. So you probably saw that lovely picture of that lady who was doing her home worship with Nataraja. And I was just over there having a dance class, and her mother was there doing some worship. So, you know, I mean, people just don't think anything of it. Whereas when it comes to the West, it becomes sort of very precious. And certainly with yoga, I mean, yoga is totally different now than it was actually in the... Yes, any other questions?
Yeah, I think if you try and find a link, what you're saying, between the hand gestures and something else, perhaps it would make sense within the context here.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So... You know, we talk about body language, don't we? Maybe some of the things that people do normally, if you're trying to make it into every day, you need to make that link between every day and the hand gestures.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe getting them to guess.
Yes, okay. Oh, with sign language, yeah, that might be an idea. I'm just wondering, what do teachers know? Because teachers, when they're approaching this material, I mean, for some of them, of course, they won't know anything about India at all. Yeah, sorry, yeah.
This morning, Dr. Sangeeta Menon brought out a very nice point that these gestures are not just giving a message, but they're also supposed to invoke within you a kind of subjective experience.
Mm. Oh, yes,
that
yeah.
takes you to a higher level.
Mm.
And I think that hasn't been mentioned at all.
Mm-hmm.
And just saying it's a sign language, it's okay, you can relate it to the Western dance in some way that you're telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's not telling of a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's more to rise within you a sense of spiritual experience, both the viewer and the dancer. And it's that relationship also comes in. I think she's better at explaining it. Having heard her, it was done very nicely.
Why don't you add something? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
It was said very nicely this morning. So,
uh-huh.
And I think that would make a huge amount of sense as to where this dance is actually placed in the Hindu society.
Well, and this then, but is it an aesthetic experience? Is it a teaching experience, or is it a religious experience? And this is what. Where the audience has to, and this is a question that I approached in my actual in my thesis work, and this I'm really glad you brought this up, because what is interesting is that the dance, and I interviewed a lot of people, is it religious, is it just theater? I mean, are people going just to see theater, or some people going just to have a religious experience, or is it just aesthetic? And it was very interesting how for each person they had a different approach. I mean, for each person doing it, whether it was the dance teacher or the audience, why the audience had come.
I mean, I've been reduced to tears when a particular thing has been shown as a dance.
Mm.
And that's because I've understood the story, and I know the story beforehand. If they say it's about Rama's Patabhisheham, and when they sing that song and it's enacted, and finally if the dancer can get the rasa out there, you end up in tears when you're watching as a person. But to the other person, it may be, oh, it's a fantastic performance, that's it.
Mm.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Another person said, it was too loud, the Nattumangam and everything else was too loud.
Uh-huh.
It was too intrusive.
Yeah.
So you have these different interpretations coming. And in some ways it is to do with what background I come from.
Yes, yeah, right.
If I can understand the story sometimes, if I'm familiar with the song and I know the meaning of that song.
And the music is good. The
music,
evokes a feeling, right, yeah, right. Because it's a whole
phenomenal feeling within you, and it can be a feeling of devotion or exhilaration, whatever it is. And I think part of the dance tradition, from what I've heard from my parents, is to enable, is another way of invoking those feelings within you and also to carry the message forward.
Also from the point of view, the tantric point of view, it's strength, isn't it? It's the strength to be able to experience a certain religious state, that the gestures are a way of embodying something, but protecting the person as well. So I had one dancer say that.
Because when Balasarswati sing Krishna Nubhaye Neva, you feel like, say, you can actually see the little baby Krishna being called, why don't you come here and play with me?
Because you have background to that particular aspect.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, I don't understand the language, no. But I know that's what she's going to. It's going to be expressed. Mm,
yeah, right.
You almost can visualize it,
mm-hmm.
And it's great how she used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So from the point of view of the actual performer, the dancer,
mm-hmm.
Western youngsters thinking more of the score or the investigative text,
mm-hmm.
do understand the power of dance,
mm-hmm.
movement from the clubbing scene.
Uh-huh.
They know how powerful
rhythm
and dance is.
Yes, right.
Quite,
mm.
quite different, but I think they appreciate, they know
yeah.
something existentially, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
One just has to watch a river dance. It just takes you.
Some people. Maybe not others, you know. No, I'm just saying that this is why it's important to draw it on the different levels. You know, like, or someone hears a great piece of music and it might take them to some level, and but somebody else not. So, yeah, so this would be a good, I think, this is really interesting in the teaching context, then, to say that it will take people then at different levels. And being tied up with, and the other point we tried to bring up is being tied up with the art. And that was my first thesis, was on Shiva and dance, myth and iconography.
Can I raise a few things?
Oh, yeah.
Because
okay,
when
sure.
I went to the Chöller exhibition, I had a very strange experience, because obviously, I mean, I know quite a bit about iconography
mm.
and how images are made. So I went into the exhibition, and I didn't actually get round the exhibition.
Oh, yeah?
I was actually stopped and was, you know, asked lots of questions by people, because I started explaining, and the next thing I knew, I had 20 people around me listening.
Oh. Huh?
And it's because people who go into the exhibition don't really know how to relate to
uh-huh,
what they're
yeah.
seeing. It's. I mean, if you went to, let's say, a European art, you'd
yeah.
have some sort of background. But this is completely no clues at all. I mean, just little placards saying
mm-hmm.
something really quite complicated in Sanskrit. So I think the difficulty is
yes, yeah,
you,
putting it in
how
context.
You access it
mm-hmm.
in a way that is not kind of dumbing down. Because one
mm.
I was with somebody who wanted really to know the symbolism.
Mm.
We had a guide who came around, and he was very dissatisfied because he was trying to sort of put it in a way that
mm.
wouldn't actually, you know, make a lot of sense for somebody who wanted to know what the symbolism was really about.
Yeah.
So I don't think you should compromise on that.
On the explanation.
Don't compromise on that at all.
Don't
underestimate.
Yes, I would agree.
Mm. Well, how did the video? I mean, did you feel that was good? Where did you feel? Did
you see,
we go?
The thing is,
did
know,
we jump some stages?
The,
in
the other aspect I've got is I've also got in touch with people who at the British Museum who had put on such exhibitions, and
oh,
they
yeah.
have the trouble of trying to say, well, how do we do it? Because, you know, here are images which are used in a religious context
mm-hmm, yeah.
without any of the trappings of religion,
mm-hmm, yeah.
presented as art or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have a similar situation here, don't you? Really, with the dance, you know, because it's without. In outside the context of
no, well, I felt that what we tried to do was to show how, in the dance, we enact what the image we show the stories behind
but
the image.
The religious context, you know, it is used within religious context.
Yes, well, and or the mythological context
right.
too. I mean, because myth, religion, it's all, you know, it's very within the traditional Indian structure.
So
there's no line that demarcates it.
No,
so
I'd like to know whereabouts is it performed, within the temple or within.
It's performed on the concert stage,
concert
and it's always
today.
Been today,
today,
and it always has been, the dual. It was performed in the temples and on the concert stage.
Right.
And what you are seeing though on the concert stage is the concert stage repertoire. Because it was very clearly demarcated as to what it was, you know, the, and so that it's a very intimate art form, and that's the other thing, is that when it's performed in a big room, to get that same feeling, you can't see, you know, you cannot see the intricate expressions and things like of the face. So, for example, when you're studying the dance, you actually learn the expressions, like you master this. And the whole thing is and how I've been taught, is that you should remain dispassionate. Like you have to evoke that feeling in the audience, but you then remain dispassionate yourself. I mean, you have to have the technique. So when you train, you first of all, of course, there's a lot of eye movements and things. So you can. Does everyone want to try moving their eyes? So you learn, like you actually hold. One of my friends said they can't stand it when I do this, but anyway. So you hold your eyes like this, and you will roll them like this. You can see this around. And this you have to have absolute mastery over it. There, okay? Then you learn how to do side to side. Now, when I am doing desire, you see this, I have to visualize my master. He is in front of me. And he says, and you also have to visualize, there's a lot of visualization, you have to visualize a man, originally. Now, if you'll notice, when you look in any ad or anything in a magazine, you will notice that all men, when they're showing that they have power, have their lower eyelid up. I dare you, look at any ad for it. They always have this lower, and they're looking at you like this. See? You see the eyelid? Just like that. Hmm? So I look at you, and I'm a man, and I'm thinking, my goodness, you're quite an attractive woman. Hmm? And I move my eyebrows up and down, and I say, come here. Then I say, you'll be sorry. Hmm. See? So you see, it's all in the face, but you have this, and you must show that complete surprise at seeing you, and then asking you to come here. Come. You'll be sorry. Hmm? You'll be sorry. But now if you're a woman, your whole demeanor has to change. And of course, when you're studying with a man, he then has that ability. So remember we did this hand sign here. So then you look, and you have to just, it's that little peek. And then you have to visualize that he's looking at your face, your shoulders, your breasts, your waist, and he's thinking, and you're thinking, ooh, he likes me. And you can feel his look. He is looking right at me. Hmm? And then I go, because I'm afraid that he's not looking at me. Hmm? So you can see that it's very subtle. It's that. Hmm? With that. And then, for disgust or contempt, you think of some professors, you know, when they say, huh, you thought you knew Sanskrit. You know, just, and that's hasya, laughter and contempt. So you have to have that. But you see, I've looked right at you, and I've outlined you, and I've said, huh. See how I look right up and down? I mean, I've really... You've had teachers do that. You've seen that. Do that, you know. You've done it yourself. That whole look of contempt. So you are then visual. You must be that person. So whenever I'm on stage, I see my dance master opposite me. He knows every movement, and he will just, and he knows when you're cutting the corners. So I try to visualize him being there. Then,
unless I missed it, Anne-Marie.
Yeah?
If I can interrupt.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we didn't talk about the rasa. Okay, yes, go ahead. Yes, good. Good.
With the movement of the body in the dance. So just as you've got contrast between creation and dissolution.
Yeah, okay.
You've also got, you know, the movement of the dance, but he's completely still.
Detachment.
Uh-huh, detachment, yes. Okay, there we go.
I think that would have been good.
Oh, no, but do, because otherwise it'll fly out, you know, yeah, and then, yeah. So this is true. So this total calm, exactly. And then, and also the ability to change moods very, very quickly. And so then when you go to anger, you jump, I was going to dance, but you can't because of the table. And you can see now that same eye, the lower eyelid is moving. So try squeezing that lower eyelid. You see that same lower eyelid, the eyes are very wide, and you are squeezing them, like that. And of course,
sparks
coming out. Exactly, right. So there you go. And so you go like that. And then you go, and then with your hands, it augments it, you see? And you're crumbling someone to death. You look way up, and then like that. So it's all with the hands and with the face. So Shiva, he has this mercurial power just to absolutely, you know, when he with the fire, when he actually takes the tiger skin. Now, for sorrow is the hardest one to do. I want everybody to just look up and think of something really sad. Just think of it. And just make your eyes dead. See how dead my eyes are? And breathe in. Just try it and breathe in. And then just look out and shake your head. Why me? Like that. So you're told to grab your chest and then look way up and then breathe heavily. And then just look down, and then let's look way back. So I'm not looking at any of you. Do you notice that? Like, I can't see any of you. My eyes are just dead. And then you look down like that. And then at the end, you grab your chest. But then for fear, look to one side. Because you know, remember as a child, someone was coming upstairs for sure. They were under the bed. So you have to go like this, and your eye, it's as if someone hits you in the head right here. Like that. So you look back like this. Of course, there you go. Hmm? You can see with the fear. Or amazement. I look at her, but I must keep looking straight ahead. Oh, that tears in my eyes. And I go, one. And I breathe in. I say, oh, look at that dress. You see, like I've kept my eyes on her, and I'm breathing in, and I'm just so happy that she is here. And so with amazement, Shiva then, you know, his wondrous feats, all the different feats that Shiva.
I mean, with iconography, the image shows, you know, you're breathing in prana.
So yeah, the prana, yeah.
So the eye, that would also be important
because
that can be easily missed with an image of,
An emotion, you mean, or the prana, the breath of the
you
whole
know,
thing?
If he's breathing in and he's full of energy, so uh-huh. the energy part of it is important to convey because the dance conveys energy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, yeah. So it takes it.
So it's also, you know, if you're connecting with the Shiva image,
and also there's only like the Shiva only has usually in this image he only has the four arms.
And very often the demon is overlooked. A lot of people ask, you know, what is the demon?
Uh-huh. Ignorance.
Very much
overlooked. Yeah.
Avidya, yes.
Yes. So being the demon of ignorance, this is
if
one thing.
If you do
avidya
versus avidya, then that's much
it
easier.
It is all any kind of demon. He stands on it.
He's often
saying,
overlooked.
No, he is also showing the sign of shanti as well with the other hand.
So if you come, you know. And pointing to the foot, you know, if you worship me, then you'll be okay.
So keep, you know, one leg away. You know, don't get stand on the
ignorance.
Empirical reality.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, people say it's heaven and. You know, Shiva has one foot in heaven and one foot on earth.
Mm. Well, this is the other thing, is that people have to realize, too, that there's just there's a myriad of images.
Yeah.
Now,
actually, if you look at the Chola images, I went around the back of them, and the detail is unbelievable.
Well, the details are quite good on this one, too.
On the back, especially around...
The hair.
Because you have Ganga, you know, the...
Oh, the goddess Ganga.
Ganga is on the back, usually.
No, usually she's she's up in here.
Either in his hair, but
yeah.
If you look at the back of Chola images, you have the.
He's up in there too, and she's usually, and she'll be coming right out of the. You see, what we tried to do is again just talk about, you know, the action. We wanted to keep it short, but it is interesting. So then we get into the goddess Ganga, and the second wife, and we thought, oh dear, how are we going to get into this one? But anyway, so
I can't not only tell a story, but also look at the what is the philosophy or the thinking of the. In Hinduism, philosophy and theology is very difficult to separate them.
You realize it comes with the booklet, and the booklet has written that.
And a lot of the philosophy comes in, and of course, through the ages, you know, the translation changes as well.
Yes, exactly. And of course, and then the myth, the Chitambara myth, is totally a South Indian myth, the one that you saw about the sages, you know, the creating of the fire, and the and then Shiva ripping off the and that. That myth is just a 15th century myth that has actually been written down, and then the destroying of the tiger. So many of these stories, of course, are often even just by rote, and some of them aren't even actually written down.
And also the jewelry, because the dress that you wear and the jewelry would be of interest, I think, to students.
Yes, with the fact that it's
and
a sari and real temple jewelry and stuff. Yeah. So
very
the temple jewelry.
I mean, one
of
the things that I was asked about was the jewelry.
Yeah.
Which I you know, was quite surprised, really. I mean, you know, people want to know about the jewelry and why the, you know.
Like with the thread and everything, yeah. Hmm.
You know, but I mean, is it the sacred thread or is it something else? You know, so there was quite a lot of interest and you got the hair
the
flowing and.
The thread denotes the one who has now. Gone to the passage of rites and
but actually
the
waistband
and is learned
is very very sort of unusual. It's very very unusual.
Yeah,
the waistband.
Yes,
worn.
So it's interesting. I mean, you
and
certainly learned a lot from like if you go around with someone that doesn't know anything, and then suddenly you think, well, I've never really thought about that.
Way
yeah,
I sort of say, well, royalty. You know, royalty would wear this kind of level of ornamentation.
Whether Shiva's royalty, I don't know. That could be a whole other area of I mean, he's certainly dressed like that, but he's, you know, he's sort of a vagabond. He has no mother and no father, and he smokes hashish,
and
you know, this whole all the stories about him.
Because the images have, in iconography, you have the three tripanga, is the three broken. So that kind of thing also is quite interesting to people.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really look, unless you point people. And say you've got to look at this. People won't look at it.
This is very true.
So
yeah, unless you actually indicate what they should be looking at. Yeah,
you've actually got to give them the. How do you put it? You've got to give them the. Unlock it. Really.
Yes, right.
Unlock the image.
So So what we found is the whole thing is how much to reveal without because so many things will lead to something else, you know, and then how much to reveal and how much to because if you give them too many things, then it gets just too totally confusing. So it's how much to actually give to them. But we did find that they certainly really enjoyed learning about the images, and they also enjoyed learning about the dance being hereditary. The other thing is that the other thing that you're going to learn a lot about is that people are saving the dance, so they're rushing over there to study. I can assure you that every child over the age of 3 is studying dance in India now. So if you read something that someone is, you know, going back to work in India to save the dance, they're just it's an absolute explosion, and it's wonderful because a lot of these hereditary people are now able to earn a decent living, because before they had, you know, it really had not. Sort of become so popular, and in studying the dance also, I talked about the first performance. I mean, what was the first performance when the girl appeared on stage? And so when it was a hereditary profession, the first performance was her appearance before society, so she could gain a patron, because she needed a patron in order to you know, maintain her lifestyle if she was going to be a hereditary traditional dancer. And so more important than her instruction as a to learn the dance was to actually be married to the god. So she was then married to the deity. She gave her first performance from all these ladies I spoke to, and they all said the same thing. But and then at that point, they then entered into a sexual relationship with the person with whom an agreement was made. But now what is very interesting to see how the first performance within the group and here and everywhere is a big party. And a lot of people don't realize this, that initially what it was, it was the coming out of a girl and then actually to be, you know, the sexual rights for the first person, essentially. And so then he would be a keep, he would look after her for some time, but then he could also, you know, not look after her. And in the repertoire is very interesting. Because in the dance repertoire, they then include this as part of the repertoire. So when the performances, we have it in the temples, we have it in the courts, but we also have it in the homes of wealthy people. And in the homes of wealthy people, women were not, in many of the women I spoke to, they were not allowed to see the dance. Only men saw the dance. So I know all your secrets. I understand your devious ways. You and I are married. But that woman has turned your head and stolen your heart. What's a strong man like you running after a girl like that? Here, there, money is no object. Respect and worship over there. Here, you inspect the accounts. Don't think I don't know what you do. Now, this is very much part of the repertoire, because these women would be entertaining in the village situation. Everybody would know what was going on. A lot of the traditional drummers would say, oh, yes, he used to go and visit this house and that house. And these were people that I work with as musicians. And when you'd go into a family and I would be interviewing this one dance teacher, and she would just say, husband not known. That meant that she was a hereditary dancer. So the dance has undergone a lot of change as to who's actually doing the dance. And then, of course, this saucy repertoire, we'll call it, it was very much a part of it. And those same women would also do something that had a lot of religious meaning, too. So they move freely between the religious and the secular. And they would all... am I confusing, or is it...
No.
I'm
just thinking of something else.
Yeah, okay. So this
how
is...
How much of these... people of the Pillai, Ramya Pillai, and so on, mm-hmm. referred to the Nati Sastra as a
tool. Ah, the dance teachers, this is the other thing. I found that the hereditary masters knew the hand signs, and they were very unconcerned with the text. Mm-hmm. They really didn't care. And they would say the same thing. I don't care about the text. So it was that actually led me to go and study with the higher caste ladies, the Kalakshetra group, because they... were very clear, very keen on making it into a codified technique. So if I was going to learn that this was Pataka, Tripitaka, Ardhapataka, the traditional masters did not know that, and nor did they care. Because I remember saying, oh, please, master, he'd say, I'm sorry, I just don't, you do it, just look at me and do it. It was part, and so that hereditary masters were not.
Would that
from
mean there's a difference in these hereditary masters were training girls to become the first courtesan or whatever, while maybe the culture, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
the people who originally followed the Natya Shastra, which was trying to rise a spiritual experience, maybe that died down and only this survived. I wonder whether that
don't
is
think, I mean, I think it's the same applies to art shastra. So, I mean, anything, I mean, Shilpa Shastra.
Mm-hmm.
So anything to do with art, it's the same principle. Art is carried on through hereditary patronage and patronage.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you've described applies also to the decorative arts, I think.
But
and the
yeah.
Shastras are there. They are, you know, the iconographical canons, which are followed, but not in in the sort of rote fashion that you might expect.
You see, I think that they would perform in a religious sense too. There was just no problem. I mean, it's modern people that have the problem moving between the religious and secular, because we want it to be all compartmentalized. But they, and as far as the text, they felt it really didn't matter, because they knew how it was being done. You know, and this is of course where there are discrepancies then between the text and what is actually taught, because the texts were you know, a group of people. And we must also remember that the Brahmins who you know looked after the texts, they also interacted with the practitioners a lot. And so some of them actually, I can remember there was one man in Madras who was this Waji Doraswamy. He was really keen, and he used to get all of us to go and study, you know, we used to go and study texts with him. But then he'd get us to go and work with the dance masters, find out what they're doing, and you know, because they will see it. And when you read the Natya Shastra, it's just a list of things that you do. They don't show you how you do it, and they don't show you any of the poetry. It's a list. That's all it is. And so for these dance masters, it didn't matter. I mean, they'll say it's a crown, it's a plate, it's a, you know, it's showing clouds. You know, I mean, when you do, you know, this particular hand sign, and so. But the dance master will know how to do it. Not only that, in each different dance style, which also uses the Natya Shastra, it will be done in a different way. So, for example, in Bharatanatyam, if I did, I am eating my dinner like this, it would be much more, see, I'm really angular. I'm very angular. Everything is like this. Now, if I'm in Odissi, I would say, my hair, and you can see that it's much more, and even the way of moving the head is like this in Odissi, whereas in Bharatanatyam, it's like that. So it's a whole different way of using the body, yet the text will say a mirror, okay? So if I'm doing this in Odissi, I would do it like that. But if I'm doing it in Bharatanatyam, it would be more upright, more like this, because my whole body, I would not be using the tribhanga as much. I mean, some dance teachers would allow you to do it. Then if I was in Kathakali, I'd be right down like this, okay? And because it's done more by men, or and Moniatam is, but you just have, so my whole shape is quite different. So if we're going to look at the dance and see which one copies the sculpture, you look at the sculpture and you find it's Odissi, like this, standing like that. And that's what got me interested in my work, because Shiva in Orissa dances like this. He does not raise his leg up. You see my foot's like, it's the sort of the ball of my foot. Shiva dances like that. So when I started to do Odissi and I went to Orissa, I said, why does Shiva dance like that? He should be like, with his foot up, he should be like that. But no, he was like that. So then I started going around, and I was reading a Patadakal and all these early sculptures. Shiva mainly has his foot down. Of course, a lot of things are you know, a lot of things have been broken. So I went around looking at all the different ways Shiva dances. And then I realized then there are other stories why Shiva dances. Shiva dances when he stands on it, when he destroys the elephant demon. So he stands like this. When he destroys his triple cities, he's usually in a dancing posture. So the most important aspect of the story is when Shiva dances. He does something heroic, he dances. And that's why dance is absolutely in the psyche of the Indian subcontinent, I would say. Because when Shiva does something, he dances. It shows his power. He can dance when he's angry or anything. And so he does that. But each different style has interpreted it in a different way.
With the Chola bronzes, even the saints
yeah.
dance, are shown dancing.
Yeah.
You know,
the Ganesh can be
shown. Yeah.
So the dance is actually obviously got some very
it's very, very,
very
deep in
very
the psyche.
Specific very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, Greek sculpture
mm-hmm.
is basically propaganda.
Yeah.
So you're selling something, you know,
mm-hmm.
whoever it might be.
Yeah.
So.
No, dance is very important. So I think people perhaps want to leave.
No, you don't.
Okay. Are there any other questions at all?
You've tested it out, you seem to indicate, on some groups in Canada.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, we've shown it to a wide variety. It's bilingual, the booklet, so it's in French and English, and we have a bilingual DVD. So we've showed it to two groups of people, and we showed it to different age groups, and we've showed it to the kids as young as like 14, 15. They loved it. They thought it was very interesting. And then I've showed it to first-year university students, second-year university students, teachers, and they found it very interesting because, of course, we're bombarded with this image of Shiva, aren't we? We can just see the god Shiva everywhere. And so that, and now when they're looking at images, they're realizing that there's more to it. And so then when you go into a church, then you start looking at the iconography. You know, why does a certain saint, you know, hold on to a skull or hold on to a certain animal or... And so you realize that the iconography is really, really important. And then, of course, there is the iconography of the tribal people who have absorbed some aspects of Hinduism and how they then have their own deities and their own goddesses and that are also slightly related to the Hindu deities. But certainly, we just felt it was very important to get people... To not just dismiss these because these are great images, yet when you see them sort of being used on in a lot of the pop culture, we felt it just devalued the use.
It's fun movement, but
and then also because of the dance, how the dance has changed a lot. And so I was recently invited this December. I was invited to India because they're trying to find out about Odissi dance. Now, Odissi dance was really only created in the 60s. It is not an old dance style, much to the... and I was there when they were creating it. So, I know the original repertoire and everything, and there were some dance masters. These dance masters had been little boy dancers, just, performing as part of a troupe and doing mainly Krishna stories, which is interesting. They then... as part of the revival movement and people wanting to have importance to their state, the Oriyas looked around and said, right, we've got to have something, we've got to have a classical style. So what did they do? They sent some of the Oriyas down to Madras, where they do Bharatanatyam, to study Bharatanatyam. They then came back and they started codifying the dance. And so then these different dances have grown out of that. And it was really interesting because then, so this conference in Orissa, you could see some of supposedly the original dances, but like I've seen the original dances and it's not that. But when you're going to use something, it's going to change. It cannot stay the same if you're going to use something. So this was very interesting. But basically, the style of dance, Odissi, it did not come from the temples. It came from little Gotipuras, little boys that went around dressed up as Radha and Krishna, and did dancing in the villages. That's where it came from. But the mythology nowadays is that it was performed in the great temple of Jagannath in Puri. And that is not right. It is just not true. Because it was not... it might have been 400 or 500 years ago, but there's not that same continuity. Whereas with Bharatanatyam was part of the temple ritual.
There's Mahamandapam in temples,
big
hall, where you can... They used to be
performing outside, and then the little tiny space inside. And where a lot of my information came was from the people who did the music, because it was like a guild. And so when you were in one of those families, that's how you learned. You went along and just hit the beat, you know, did the talam, did the beat for the musicians. And so they would describe what it was like, what the repertoire was like, what the dancers, what the teachers wore, and the dance teachers wore. And that was just how it was done. So it was really a great honor to study with someone, and that's all they'd done. They were brought up, and they were going to do dance. That was it. And so, as dance teachers. So this is why it's such a rich tradition. But then now it's being codified. So we're going back to the text and codifying it. And what's interesting is, as a living tradition, it matches up well with the text also, and in some ways it there is some discrepancy there.
Do you think you need narrative to bring to bear on the... do you need a narrative or a story to bring to bear to understand it properly, or can you appreciate it? Is the level of appreciation just without the story, without the information?
I think the information is really important, yeah. And particularly because, you know, there's so many, particularly like with, you know, India's very urban, and so when I perform in India, I offer explanation, and they really like it because you enter then into that world, and it's the same as when you look at the images, you know, if you just your whole appreciation grows so much when you're introduced to little variations and things on it. So of course you can get too many explanations too. Sometimes it can be too didactic, but otherwise. And then the other thing that's happening is people are picking new themes. And you know, and the themes are changing because the audiences want to see something different. Mm-hmm. We want to see something that is and different regional styles, whereas they were from one particular area and the people understood that linguistic the language of that area. Well, now you know, people don't want to for example, the man I study Kathakali with, that he does Othello in Malayalam. You know, and so what they have to do is, of course, they have to have a translation in into English so that people then can understand. I just keep saying, why don't you just do it in English? If you're doing it in Delhi, more people know English than Malayalam. But anyway, the trouble is they would have to then train up their singers to sing in English, so they won't do it. But it's when you know the story, it's amazing to see. And the same thing is in Bharatanatyam, whereas they used the regional languages of Tamil, Telugu, Kannaries, and of course there's some Sanskrit. When they go to Delhi, nobody knows. I mean, they just sit and watch it with the same... And the teaching of the dance is usually done in English, because all the girls, except if you're in Madras, because all the girls, there'll be a wide variety of... Or it's taught in Hindi or whatever, even... And so the songs, no one will even know what the songs are about. You just enact the songs, that's all. Because they're in languages that are... So it's the beauty of the music and the... So it's not understood by everybody, is what we're basically what I'm trying to say. And also, linguistically, it's changed, too, because the repertoire used to be a Telugu repertoire, and now, because of the Tamil... interest in the Tamil language in Chennai, the repertoire is changing, and they're singing more songs in Tamil than they used to. Usually the master I studied with, Elipa, he only did Telugu repertoire. That's all he did. And Bala, mostly Telugu. But then she did some Tamil. But then now, because the people in Madras don't speak as much, and the best music is in Telugu. It's not as simple as it appears. That everybody sort of, you know, India is not homogeneous. It's really more different than all the different aspects of Europe. But I certainly think of any dance style, it's hard to know of any country that there aren't people that of that nationality doing it. Because I've performed and taught in Greece, and there are lots of Greeks doing it, lots of Ukrainians doing it, Brazil, Mexico. In Delhi, some styles are going to be saved by the Japanese. There's so many Japanese students there. It's just, and there's an all-female French troupe that does Kathakali. And then, so that these, because they're classical styles and you study the rules of how you do it, it's open to anyone. It's like anyone from the world could learn ballet if they want, or the cello, or any classical style. So it really is a very... universal form, so lots and lots of people from every culture are there, you know, studying it, and they're welcome too, to come and learn it, because as they say, either you can do it or you can't do it. So they don't mind if you come from, you know, from another culture or whatever it is to come and actually study it. So it's not an ethnic form, shall we say? You know, it's not like learning North American Indian dancing or something like that, because it's based on rules. So people can look at it and they can say either she knows it or he or she knows her stuff. The other thing is, men are now doing the dance. Men should not be doing the dance. It was considered very, very inauspicious for a man to do Bharatanatyam, because the whole idea was you were the bride of God, you know? But then they started dance, and then but there was dance at weddings in the secular sense. So sometimes, maybe like this, the master had a son, and so they do a double dance, maybe the girl and the boy doing the dance. And then men started looking at the dance and thinking, now this is, it's interesting. Let's start doing the dance. So men now do the dance. Now, when for my research, the book's also available at here as well as in the library. A lot of people just felt that they couldn't stand it, the idea of a man doing Bharatanatyam. Now, some styles, and this is my latest research, is men dressed in drag. And that's one style called Kuchipudi. But in the early 70s, it's a really fun style. So the women started saying, hey, let's do this one. So now it's more famous, the style is more famous to be done by women than by men, because in the village situation, it was a hereditary thing. And again, that was done by high caste men, which is quite interesting. It's another story in itself. And they had these wonderful, long plaits, and then they'd hang them over the curtain. But the whole dance style was really fun and very, very provocative, really provocative, the way they'd walk around and flirt with the audience. And they would pick, a lot of stories with conflict between the god and goddesses. So it was really fun. And so now it's, I would say women have really taken, there's still some men that do it, and now there are men and women doing it. So it's like Shiva and Parvati dancing together.
Aren't there women now starting to learn to do Kathakali?
Oh, yes, I was going to say, definitely lots of women doing Kathakali. As I said, there's a whole female troupe. And there's a whole group of French women that do it. I've studied Kathakali. Mm-hmm. And
just in general in India, that
oh, yes, yeah.
Totally unheard of that.
Before, yeah.
Before that women would have done that.
And it's because the dance, there's such a resurgence in the dance, too. But because you are that, you can be male and you can be female. We are Ardhanarishvara, we are half man within us. So there really isn't any problem, as long as you get your makeup on right, because for doing it, this would be how it would be done. In Kathakali, often one would study either the male or the female roles, but and you would become an expert at one or the other. You'd study many of the male roles or many of the female roles, yeah. But so that would be how it would be done. So it's a fascinating world that I would like you to enter if you could, and I want to thank you all for being here. It was so
thank
nice.
You so much
yeah,
for coming to talk to us. Thank you.
And I hope. Can I have people's emails? Would you mind writing your email on just before you depart? Maybe you people want to go faster, so why don't you write your emails on there? Take a clean sheet of paper because I wrote down your ideas. And yeah, we'll start here. There you go. And I get start at the top. Wait, just start at the top of the page. There we go.
Well, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
Sharing your,
so, and I have, and my website and everything is, it's Cultural Horizons. If you want to write it down, my email and
please show the book.
Oh, the book. Yes, yes. There you go.
So,
and
thanks
this is,
very much.
And if anyone wants to buy this, it's £10.
I'll pay for it tomorrow and report back to you. On
you will, aren't you?
Yes.
Isn't that wonderful? You see, there you go. Yeah.
Because
and they're fresh too, aren't they? They're totally fresh.
You've got a load in here to sell.
Yes, yes,
I
do. Yeah.
You haven't been thanked.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Oh. Well, thank you very much. I really feel bad selling this, but I can't do it any other way because, and then we'll be able to pay for our Krishna one, you see.
Yes.
It's only in that context, yeah. So, yeah.
To what extent? I mean, you have
oh,
you got
yeah.
some other appointments.
Yeah, yeah. Bye-bye. Thank you for coming.
What context, I know very little about this, but
yeah.
In terms of the Mughal Empire and their...
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah,
there's
a copy.
Courtesans
oh, good.
And so on in the northern India.
Yeah, right? Ta-da!
Whether
you're going to get one. I just want to make sure that it's got it. Yeah, it's got it in it. She got it. You got yours, eh?
I've got one.
Oh, good. I just want to make sure. Check that there's something. Yeah, thank you. So you're also crossing. Oh, and I've got change. Here we go. Thank you. Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And then, so Krishna will come next year. Or we're actually working on one on Buddhism now. Hmm. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming. Yes, so we'll see you. And you'll, yeah, yeah. And we're in the basement flat. If you want to knock on our door, 36. Yeah, good, good. Should we take this out of here? Yeah. Mm. Thank you, Nick. Yes.
You don't presume.
Yeah.
For pedagogic purposes.
Yeah.
Want, put in early history, I mean, references to Rudra and Veda.
Well, there. Ah, now they said this is again. Yeah, and this is a good point. Mm-hmm. We didn't know how far back to go, but yeah, but that's good. Yeah. Well, bye bye. Well, thank you. So we'll see you. It's how much to include.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and sometimes you wish that
the teaching purposes, it's how much to exclude, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
to do a decent job.
And the main thing is, because it's how much to put in and how much to leave out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing. And actually, we're lucky. The High Commissioner for India to Canada really liked it, so we got the approval.
the thing that I'm looking at is because a lot of the temple carvings, I'm told.
Thank you, Nick. For coming. Yeah. Anyway,
so
no, I have your email, Nick, or not? Do you want to?
Yes,
oh, good, good. Thanks, yeah.
You've been to Chidambaram. But there are all these, a lot of the dance poses.
Around
the temple.
Yeah. Thank you. Good. I'm off to teach now. Oh, this is Shaheen, yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, yes.